Where's enter full screen?
There, enter full screen, review, top one.
Did I just do that? Oh yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think I'm going to show this one.
Okay. Do you want to? Are we already technical?
I think so, but I think Faisal just wants to check that if it's unmuted. Do you want me to play it, Faisal? Yeah, it probably wants to be a bit louder. Okay. Okay. How do I start it again? Just by doing that. Okay. Right now you can do this.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Arnolfini, UE and Art in the City lecture series. My name's Helen Davis, and I'm Arnolfini's curator for learning. And before the lecture starts, I just want to introduce you a little bit to Arnolfini. So we are a contemporary arts centre. So we have a programme around the visual arts. Our exhibition at the moment's Matty Braun. Do have a look at that if you haven't already seen it. We have live performance, dance, film, music, and we have a whole learning programme. So one of the things that we'd really like you to do is to engage with Arnolfini on all different levels. And we've got some flyers that will be given to you on the way out. We've got some careers events that you may be interested in. These are informal portfolio sessions that you can have with experts in the industry. So they're Arnolfini staff, but as well as that, we've brought in people from Spike Island, Pervasive Media Studio. So the next one's tomorrow, but they're every Thursday. So do have a look at this and take us up on this offer, because we are a resource here for you to use. And we're your future employers and future commissioners, so take advantage. So tonight, we've got Stephen Claydon, and I'd like to introduce Michael Pryor, who's been the independent curator who's commissioned Stephen's work for Bristol. So Michael's going to introduce Stephen to you this evening. Thanks, Michael.
Hi there. Thanks for coming along. I first came across Stephen's work and Arnolfini Galleries, in fact, quite a few years ago now, in a group show called Pale Carnage. Do check out the catalogue if you can find it in the bookshop. And there was an amazing work, or a couple of works that Stephen had in that show, combining materials like mylar, this kind of space-age material, with figures and busts with oversized ears, and I'm sure there was a black bin liner in there somewhere as part of it, and clay and so on. It's an incredible combination of different materials. Partly there, it was just intriguing, but also what you'll see, I think, is typical of Stephen's work, that importance of materials and what they symbolize, or what they their cultural significance and what we associate with them, as well as a combination of imagery, which in this piece I've just been talking about, Pale Carnage, was kind of part Viking, part sci-fi, an incredible combination of imagery. A few years later, I had an opportunity to curate a new work, produce a new work for a hospital building on the edge of Bristol, and approached Stephen to ask him, because I saw some connections between this amazing Victorian building that had a very particular kind of history to it, and the contemporary upgrade of the hospital that the NHS were now going to provide this building with. And I'm very pleased to say that he accepted the challenge, if you like, or the offer of producing this new work for Bristol. And so Stephen's been in Bristol on and off the last couple of years developing this new work. And so I'm very pleased to welcome him here now, partly to talk about work that he's been producing over a period of time, but also going to be talking a little about the work he's producing for Cosham Hospital in Bristol. So please give Stephen a great welcome. Thank you.
Thanks, Michael. I had a bit of a last minute change of plan, and in relation to what Michael's just said about materiality, which is something that's quite core to the practice, but in tandem with sort of multiple other kind of events and migrations of events and agency and materiality. I thought what I would like to do is show a recent film first, and then I'll run through some shows dating back a few years, and then at the end we can maybe talk a little bit more about the practice at large. So what I'm going to do is going to play this, and it's about 10 minutes long, but I thought it'd be better to play it now. It's quite emblematic, I think, in some respects, of where the practice is at this stage, or at least one sort of facet of that practice. So here it is. Thank you.
Thank you.
fiddling to get back into the PowerPoint thing. Don't mind. So what I was doing, what I wanted to do there was to illustrate this kind of curious sort of relationship between a social agency, a kind of thingy agency of objects and events and utility, how we confer status onto a thing and how ultimately things operate outside of our jurisdiction. So what do I do now? What am I doing now? Do that. Here we are. So bear that in mind a little bit. So what I'm going to do is play, show you a few images. It's a bit kind of conceited, but I wanted to translate my name into a Wingdings font, into a different font. Purely because I'm interested in that kind of translation of of language as an object, as an event, as a thing, and how we construe different kind of things from different placements and arrays of meaning and objectivity and subjectivity. So I'm going to go quite far back to 2006. Bear in mind that this is just kind of cherry-picked. I didn't put everything in, but I wanted to put this in because I think it's about the kind of beginning of, it's not a very good slide, but it's the beginning of the kind of work that I'm still sort of involved in now, the kind of climate of interrelated, orbiting, peripatetic subjectivity and objectivity and that kind of keeps me going. This was called The Glidded Baum, and it was based on a book by J.G. Fraser, like arguably the first proper anthropological treatise, which tried to understand humans' relationship with magic and the supernatural, and with ultimately with the world around us and objects, using it as a kind of conduit. And it was also to do with a body of works by Oscar Schlemmer, called Das Lack Cabinet, and it was to do with extinction of trends, extinction of genres, extinction of these cassowaries, perhaps the ultimate extinction of things, and the kind of swan song period of a movement like Bauhaus, or anything. This late flowering in a this kind of late growth spurt in a thing that's just about to kind of give up the ghost, but ultimately has a resonance historically as a kind of narrative kind of object. And I'll keep trying to talk about thoughts as objects, and I think it relates to this this idea I've got about a kind of secular animism of things, basically this toing and froing between a thing's social agency is something that we use and we can talk about, and then its actual potency or potential potency, potent potentiality as a thing within itself, with all its hiding, all its like inbuilt bits and pieces. I put this in because there's a recurrent thing in my work. Like anyone, we're interested in other work, in other art, and I've been asked on a couple of occasions to curate things, and this wasn't the first time I curated a show, but it was certainly the biggest opportunity I've had to try to not show the things that I like necessarily, but show the things, or at least show an approach to kind of operating amongst things and objects and art objects and curation and all of the politics and strange metering that goes on around the aggregation of a show or of objects in a space. And it was called Strange Events. I'm not going to drink that now. Oh, wait. Strange Events Permit Themselves the Luxury of Occurring, which in itself is an interesting thing. It's a fictional quote. So I've quoted a fictional character, which is Charlie Chan, this fictional detective, And I can't remember where I found it. Actually, I can remember. It was in this very peculiar book that I picked up for nothing in a secondhand bookshop. And it had this great quote from Charlie Chan, and I always remember it. Does it have any more veracity? Does it have any more or less veracity because the quote comes from a fictional character? Does it have any less credence? And for me, that's really part of the way I think about how I encounter objects. And here you can see works from Jim Shaw, Thomas Halsago, Francis Beccaria, Lynn Chadwick, Eduardo Palazzi, a lot of English stuff. I had the liberty to work with the Arts Council collection, and there are artists in here that I'd never heard of before, but I wanted to create a kind of climate of interrelated or associative equivalences that stemmed from a kind of the catalyst of being asked to do this thing. I was also asked to put my own work in, and I often ask myself whether it was actually wise or folly to include my own work, but you know, enough time has elapsed that I don't necessarily care anymore. This is one of my works, and this is one of these kind of arrested equivalences formed from a casual equivalence that I still am concerned with in the work now. I developed a painting out of a drawing from a comic book, and I also was able, after quite a long process, to get a bronze hand from a decommissioned sculpture. Now, sculptures are not very often decommissioned, but this one was so bad that within 5 minutes they'd had to put the veil back over it. The family of the deceased football manager whose sculpture it was so distraught that they did that. And I managed to find the foundry that had commissioned it and also decommissioned the piece, and I managed to get this hand. And so I took out, I took out one of the knuckles on the finger, which resembled exactly this image that I had from a comic book from the 1980s or 90s called 2000 AD. And so I was trying to make an equivalence. The equivalences I make aren't just sort of clever things, oh look, this looks like that. What it is a catalyst to try to make myself and perhaps others try to question the way that we are seduced by narrative, or at least narrative suggests itself before we even think about it. And in advertising and in film, that's called the suspension of disbelief or the spectacle, if you read Guy Debord. And so often I'll employ kind of techniques and formula that are taken as rote within a common collective understanding of how, for instance, an artifact might be deployed in a museum or the kind of housing and furniture of the museum or the institution, and the politics and the utility and the cultural canon and the currency that starts to happen when you take a thing and you say this is different to other things. You bestow a kind of cultural value on it. And often I'm concerned with what happens when a culturally augmented, if you like, object's nature is in direct sort of relationship or even in opposition to its material nature. And often I've tried to sort of use various conceits to sort of amplify that by using cast things in oregano, for instance, when they should be bronze. There are material, you know, problematics that I've purposefully introduced, but often I don't have to. Like on this occasion, it was all done for me, so I used bronze, which is something I don't think I'd ever use unless it was a pre-existing object. That was a work by Bonnie Camplin. Behind it is work by an American artist whose name has just completely escaped me, but who's been with me all my life. I think I found a catalogue of his when I was a teenager, and what's his bloody name again? Anyway, I often find that I've got more in common with artists I don't like than artists I like. Similarly, and I'm jumping a few years now, jumping past the show I did at Arnold Feeney, actually, which was curated by Martin Clark, called The Dark Monarch, which I had a couple of pieces in. But because I've shown the film, and because there's more to talk about than just showing you bits of work, you can look at them online, I guess. I wanted to move to this show, and this was an interesting show for me because it was housed in the Haus der Kunst in Munich, which used to be the Haus der Deutsche Kunst, and was was a brainchild of the NSDAP, which was the Nazi party, to show German art. So it was called the Haus der Deutsche Kunst. It was to show German art. And after the war, it briefly was the headquarters for the Americans, and then it became an art gallery again, just Haus der Kunst. And for me, I thought, oh God, this is too much. The weight of history is too much there. But I thought, if I can't do a show here that can start to play with how institutions can colour the way we view artefacts and objects and artworks and culture in general, on a minute scale and at large, then I should give up. It's not to say that I didn't directly get involved with that. Some of the placements, like these two, these are ceramic girders. They're RSJs, and I'm interested in things like RSJs and bricks and atoms and pixels, because they're lowest common denominator things that accrue into more complex things, and ultimately are given some kind of value. Like a girder is the framework of a building, that it might become a building like the Natural History Museum, which is built around a metal framework. Most people don't realise that, because it's got this kind of gothic, neo-gothic conceit. But also a pixel, an image is, like this image, is made out of pixels. So I'm always trying to be aware of like these lowest common denominator things. And I was allowed access to the archive of this building, and I placed these two like ceramic, very fragile things that represent very sort of unassailable things, both sort of emblematically and physically, in the same place that these two sculptures had been placed in a show in the 1940s. I also housed some work by an artist illustrator called Olaf Gulbrandsen, who was a Norwegian who'd moved to Germany in the 20s. And started working for a German magazine called Simplicissimus, which was a satirical magazine, a bit like our Punch magazine, which no longer exists. But he was an interesting character. And the reason I say this is because one of the other things, and one of the main things in the work, is this notion of migration, the notion of material migration, historical migration. I'm going to refer to my notes now. That's it, yeah. Virtual, material, historical migration, and the way that people and objects move through physically, virtually, and through historical processes what have you. This was a hippo skull covered in toothpaste, and a cast of a hippo skull covered in toothpaste and sun cream. Hippos secrete a special pink liquid that swims down their back to protect them from the sun, and it's very much like a kind of sun cream. But they, in this area, there's a lot of fossils found, and that's why I employed this. And this is where Archaeopteryx was found, very near Munich. So I'm trying to sort of make these established relationships and then break them again and then re-establish them. You know, that's by the by. You know, that you could just say that's just arty conceit, but really what I'm trying to do for myself is to have this kind of what Heidegger calls this kind of I think it's a kind of oscillation between the revealed object as a cultural signifier, as agency, as cultural agency, social agency, and its inner sort of nature as discrete non-divulging substance, if you like, substrate. This is a piece called On the Marble Cliffs. No, it's not. It's called Atop the Loam. And the character here is wearing this typically bourgeois coat from that area, from Munich, that you can sort of identify people actually throughout Europe by wearing these special Leuden coats which have a kind of dart down the back. And so it was to do with taste. So it's just as much to do with taste and taste making and cultural canons as it is to do with the physical stuff. So there's always this meeting between cultural significance and material significance. This piece in the foreground, I'm going to go on forever if I do it like this, but this piece in the foreground is called Renaissance Malt. And in relation to the film I showed you earlier, the soundtrack, most of it, was made by people trying to reenact Renaissance music or try to figure out what late medieval and early Renaissance music was about. And some of the objects here were my attempts to make a thing called a racket, which was this multi-board, strange, cylindrical little woodwind instrument that became extinct. And when I was looking on the internet to find out about the Renaissance racket, people for scale who were trying to make them themselves were using little bottles of steam ale and microbrewery ale to use as scale. And so I was thinking about the collection and the early Renaissance and the collection that became the museum. And then I was thinking about how we collate and collect information now via the internet. And also I wanted to use something that is a bit more sort of esoteric. And the way I established this was by using this Pythagorean discovery, which was the dodecahedron. And the Pythagoreans were so scared that the dodecahedron, the formula for the dodecahedron, would get into the wrong hands, that they suppressed it for centuries, and only later were we able to figure out that you know, this was just another object. But actually, Pythagoreanism, far from being this rational, mathematical kind of the way we understand it now, is this rational mathematical thing, was almost a religion. In fact, it was a kind of religion. Because they constantly found that there's relationships between all these numbers, and they thought there might be some kind of power or potency to these numbers. And again, that relates to constantly what I'm figuring out is that our anthropocentric perspective and the way we encounter things and attribute meanings to things, even if there is no apparent meaning, we make that connection. This is one of my favourite pieces. I don't think I've got that much time to talk about it. There's an image of a Neanderthal in there, and then these objects that appear like mammoth bones or modernist sculpture. I've jumped again quite far. This is a show, much more pared back show, that I did last year in Lyon. And if I needed proof that the kind of method and the way that I understand humans to create connections between things happens, this was very serendipitous and almost ridiculous. I on a kind of whimsical level, I was used to sort of navigating my way around London, and I always go down this street, or I have done for many years, called Monmouth Street, and on it is the oldest surviving French restaurant in London. And in the window are these really mental ceramics, these two figures, and I'd seen for maybe 15 years. And I decided I'd like to investigate them as sort of preliminary research for this show I was going to do in Lyon. And I think everyone wants me to go in there and make a head based on various despotic rulers and my own imagination or whatever, but I really wanted to make a show that was based around an existing object in this case. That doesn't mean to say that it didn't end up differently, and I'll show you why in a moment. But I managed to talk to the patron of this place. He's a completely sort of eccentric, mistrustful old Frenchman called, I thought his name was Pascal. It's not Pascal. What's his name? I forget his name. But he says, "I only want to know you're not a gangster." He had this really kind of comedy French accent. And eventually, after a long time, actually, he allowed me to take these things away. And he told me, actually, a story which was interesting for me, because he was convinced he'd bought them in Lyon, in a flea market. And then his memory served him better a bit later on, and he realized they were from Paris. But then once I'd got hold of the objects, I was able to distinguish from the potter's marks that they were from Brittany. But he'd bought them in Paris. He was born near Lyon, it turns out. And his restaurant is called Mon Plaisir. And so I wanted to call it Mon Plaisir, Votre Travail, my pleasure, your work. But it turns out that when I went to visit Lyon, there's a district of Lyon called Mon Plaisir. And so there was all these sort of connections establishing themselves. And when I see a connection like that, I feel sort of compelled to concrete or arrest that equivalence, to arrest that relationship or that association and force it into being. And so I made a show based around that. But I was also thinking about the migration of these objects from France, from Brittany to Paris, from Paris to via this guy from Lyon to London, and then back again to Lyon. And so I got in touch with a guy who makes historical replicas of for museums predominantly of and collectors of late medieval and Renaissance ceramics, and he also makes Roman ceramics, but this is his speciality. And so he uses the same clay and the same minerals to create these objects. And I was thinking this is a kind of reanimation, or at least an anthropomorphic or zoomorphic sort of enterprise. And so I asked him to make one of these things in the way it would have been made in the 15th century. And he came up with this, and we talked about these kind of jokes that they would often put in, and he said, "What about a phallus? You never see them in museums, but they often use kind of phalluses as the handles for cooking pots." And I thought it fitted with the sort of priapic nature of these objects anyway. And so he built a kind of shallow dish which was part of this object as a phallus. And what I did was to use a synthesizer from my previous incarnation as a musician to sort of animate this thing. So I found what I'm interested in, and what I was interested in the band was using music as an evocation of animation, if you like. And so I found I manufactured through the circuits, which is very different on an analog keyboard to a digital keyboard, this sound that sounded like talking. So every hour, actually it was every half an hour, the light would change on this object from yellow to green. The gallery assistant would place the head on the object and then play a piece that I'd written on the synthesizer. I use barrels as a motif, in the same way that I use bricks and pixels and blocks as a lowest common denominator object. For instance, a piece that's in that the Tate unwisely bought recently consists of a barrel with which shipped olives from Kalamata in the Greek mainland to London, with a Roman olive oil vessel which I bought from an antiquarian store near the British Museum, which at one stage had the same significance, I'm sure, as a piece of detritus once it had fulfilled its function that a barrel does now. Often barrels end up as water butts. They fulfill all kinds of objects. You know, you use them to stop your boat bashing against the side of a jetty or something. But what I'd been doing with them is to fill the barrels with foam so that they become solid. So their utility as a container or as a vessel practically has been removed. But nevertheless, they retain a cultural utility as a vessel for us to place meaning on. and that's it yellow, but they forgot to take the head off for the photograph. Never mind. This is the kind of opposite of me curating things into shows. This was me being asked by a curator to make this pattern, this kind of wallpaper based on the one pixel that I'd then generated into a pattern that looked a bit like Hessian, I think, as a backdrop for some other works. And there's a Paul Tech in there. But for me, just as interestingly, there's also this beautiful kind of emergency light. And and by creating a backdrop for an artwork and for a pre-existing object, that equivalence for me has been made. So my work sort of, I wouldn't say, yeah, it's operating. It sounds a bit sort of self-aggrandizing, but it's operating. It's still operating in the way, even though this is a kind of discrete object, this wallpaper, it's still kind of housing these other things, and that's the way I think things operate anyway. But I think I'm just making these very obvious statements in order to try to constantly remind ourselves that we're part of, we're not just part of a culture that wants us to swallow history and visual language and to make itself part of that canon, but also we have an inbuilt, we're hardwired to make connections between things, because it's easier to do that as individuals trying to evolve, if you like, than it is to constantly question. Actually, I think there's a nice kind of relationship between gullibility and a kind of questioning. That dynamic for me is fundamental, and it links to this notion of this oscillation between revealing and concealing that I'm interested in, or at least that I've got from reading this one essay by Heidegger. He never really saw it like that. But and I'm not necessarily all that interested in Heidegger. When I was at art school, it was post-structuralism. I was interested in French philosophy, but there's something about what he writes about that I think is really contingent, really, to use one of his words. This is a show I did in Norway last year. The lighting was bought locally from a shipyard, and they use it to catch squid, to lure squid. And I just thought it was kind of apt, even though a little bit cheesy, to use a lure as lighting for an art object. And likewise, despite the fact it looks kind of brown, there was this kind of emergency arresting yellow that I used to frame a film and a found object as ceramic. We're often used to seeing ceramics as vessels, but on this occasion it's a conduit. It's an impedance to stop electricity being transmitted through to the ground to kill us all. So that's just part of a wiring. But it's showing a film that I made called The Ancient Set. And I was really interested to do this show in this part of Norway, because it's within the Arctic Circle, and there was evidence that this stoneware from the Rhineland from the Middle Ages had reached this far up into what was then very barbaric land, and most of Europe used this stoneware from the Rhineland because it was very waterproof and you could drink out of it, basically. And it was not only that, it added some kind of antiseptic nature. So what I did was to think about this potter, studio potter that I'm interested in, called Hans Koper, who left the Rhineland in the 1930s to escape persecution by the Nazis, and moved to Britain and made these beautiful pots that resembled, for me, at least in a small way, these pots that had come from the Rhineland and were familiar from seeing in like Bruegel paintings, etc. So I sort of conflated the two. I made these these pots which were made in stoneware, fired with bracken, which has potassium in it, which gives this nice sort of watertight glaze. And on this occasion I didn't use it, but I used this manganese glaze that Hans Koper used and arguably led to his death from contact with the stuff. And I also made these aluminium. Now, aluminium, again, is an interesting substance. Up until the beginning of the last century, it was incredibly difficult to extract aluminium from its ore, which is called bauxite. And there's an autobiographical thing in there, because my teacher who was responsible for giving me detention at school called me bauxite. I never had any understanding why. I didn't even ask him, but he just used to say, "Bauxite, Clayton, bauxite." And I just sit there, you know, every week in detention. But bauxite's really fascinating for me because you have to use this incredible electromagnetic process to extract the ore. And to the point that royal dinner services, especially of the last Napoleon, Emperor Napoleon in France, he had an aluminium dinner service and everyone else had gold. So it was that difficult to extract that it was that precious, even though bauxite is the most common metal ore on the surface of the planet. And so I wanted to, when I do use metal to cast things, I want to use something that has this democracy, because it is the most abundant. And it's the not the opposite of bronze, but it has a very different sort of resonance. Yeah. And I wanted to sort of make some face pots, or I've forgotten the word that they used in the Rhineland. There's bellarmine pots, but there's also something to do with the beard. I've forgotten what it's called now. Anyway, these pots, there was hundreds and hundreds of thousands of them produced every year, and they went from every region from the Rhineland to be imported. Now, in Britain, the little faces they put on them, they made to resemble a defeated Scottishman. But in Scandinavia, they put a little forked beard or a pointed beard, like in these two gentlemen, to resemble the hairstyles of that area, basically Viking sort of hairstyles. And these fragments of these were found in near Lofoten in the Arctic Circle. So I made a piece sort of around that. Also, in the local museum that I visited on a sort of research visit, I found these drawings, these watercolours of the Seven Dwarfs that the curator claims were made by Adolf Hitler and got to the island during the Nazi occupation in the 1940s. And so this is, so I wanted to use them in relation to the bearded figures on the pot, but I didn't make any direct relationship to it. I didn't think that was apt for some reason, but I did drill the faces out of them in the way that I'd done the same thing on these, with this sort of diamond tip thing. And also, there was a relationship to the sort of prohibition of alcohol in that area. These are wine bags that Doc is inspecting there. Oh yeah, and here you can just see. So I wanted to get the artworks into the substance of the environment and in a slightly sort of backhanded, ironic way. There he is. I'm not going to talk about this for long, but when I did the show at First Sight recently, they asked me to curate one of the rooms which is supposed to relate to the area. It's a difficult building. It's a brand new art space that isn't necessarily all that suited to showing art. And they said we need something with local... and I said, I just don't know if I can do it. I'll think about it. But quite soon I employed the same sort of... peripatetic sort of orbiting around stuff that often conjures really quite unexpected results in my own work. And I started to look at these cloud studies, which were part of a number of works which were suggested to me by the curator, Michelle Cotton, and things to look at. And it put me in mind of these photographs by Stieglitz that he called equivalents, which were studies of clouds from the 1930s and 40s. And then I started to think about, at least it reminded me that there might have been some relationship between Carl Andre's equivalent series, which caused so much kind of shock in the 1970s when it was displayed at the Tate in London. As it evoked recently in Colchester when I displayed it there. And so what he was thinking of was these things weren't sort of gravitationally bound, that there was some kind of relationship between this pile of fire bricks and clouds. And for me, outside of that kind of art, that conceptual idea that a thing kind of escapes its gravitational pull once it's designated as an art object, I was interested actually in the material side of it as well, that these things are full of, they're incredibly porous, and they're full of sort of these little modules of clay which bubble together and in a way are quite similar to the way that raindrops accrete to make up cloud formations. And so I thought, okay, well, I've got something. And I think it was the day before the deadline for having to, really a couple of weeks before the show, that I was going to pull the whole thing because I couldn't get one of these Carl Andre works, and I think there are eight in the world, that I got a phone call from somebody saying that we'd got one. And I'm so glad it happened. And I apologize for the awful floor in that room, but it is a bit like cascading rain, isn't it? Anyway, that's more of a kind of a plan view. So I showed these images with the Carl Andre, and I think it worked. Actually, it worked quite well in relationship to some of my works, and not to say that I'm all that self-serving, but you'll see in a minute why. But I'm interested in pixels, I'm interested in photons, which are carrier particles for light, I'm interested in the carrier particles for sound. This piece, this wallpaper piece that I made out of pixels that resembles a digital idea of light is based on the notion of the photon as a particle, as light as an object. And I'm interested in light as things, as language as objects, as light as object, blah, blah, blah. And down below there's a very early attempt to computer generate a 3D image, which I've equated with a piece by Willy Baumgarten, which was a kind of defacement of a totemic kind of neoclassical piece of art in where he drew kind of glasses around the bollocks and turned the nose into a something. That's a ceramic bell, which acted as a. What did it act as? It acted to create feedback from the mic that was hung in it. Instead of a clapper, it became a cross between an alarm, which actually I guess a bell is to some degree, and also a receiver. So it received itself in this sort of cannibalistic, onanistic, self-reflexive way. It received its own signal and then resonated that signal as feedback because of the amp that's placed on the bottom there. And this is where I can come to sort of Carl Andre, I suppose. And also, again, there's something slightly autobiographical about these. These are London bricks, and I'm from London. You know, that's where the equivalence ends. But I'm really fascinated by the notion of the London brick and that London is based on clay. And clay makes bricks, and then these bricks, I call them pixels, London pixels it's called, and they're made of aluminium, polished aluminium, which I've I've talked about earlier. This is also based on a diagram of how pixelation affects the way we understand an image. So there's this thing called aliasing or staircasing that happens. We're all familiar with it when you try to describe a curve out of pixels and it has this little jagged edge. And this piece is made out of beeswax sheets, which are used as foundations for artificially starting colonies of bees, which operate in a similarly sort of complicit way with one another. I'm sure there's loads I'm missing out, actually. In front of it is a piece that was based on a number of things, but specifically a piece that I encountered when I was in Lyon in this brutalist museum based on the Roman heritage of the city, and a plinth and a display in the Science Museum of the first steam engine. So there was this sort of funerary bear, this funerary urn, surrounded by a chariot that had been found in Lyon from perhaps the first century BC or the first century AD, and the beginnings of technology, of the industrial revolution, of industrialization, of like this auto-reflexive thing, this machine that could pull itself along. And for me, always that self-reflexivity within a thing is interesting. But I use this face pot idea of this Bellarmine to create this sort of Dionysic image of this unsung kind of author of the theory of evolution, Alfred Russel Wallace, who's forgotten in the shadow of Darwin as one of the co-authors of the theory of evolution through natural selection. And it's these evolutions and these kind of obliterations and obscure moments in history and within and the way that we employ a blinkered view in order to make our lives easier, that I'm trying to work with. The wheel in the center is taken from a Harley Davidson I bought from a 30-something Polish man who lived in Hemel Hempstead with his mum, and she didn't want it in the house anymore and it had been in the garden, so I bought it on eBay and went and got it in a van. And then the wheels are taken from a drawing, an early uh, 3G drawing of a wheel that was made in three dimensions, and from a sculpture that I found in a book on Yugoslavian architecture, which had a tank wheel or something like that. This piece was never intended to be a piece. It was intended to be a display of discrete things that suddenly start to maintain language between them. That's what I wanted to do, was to have one piece in the show that would never be a piece after the show. It was the sum total of its parts. It was the sum of its parts, and then afterwards it would they would all disappear again, and maybe they'll reappear in other sculptures. I don't know. The disc target piece actually isn't a target at all. It was based on something in the Science Museum again of a early astronomer's disc to reflect the stars onto this mirror polished piece of steel. But throughout the show, I try in the film I showed you earlier, and in the show, I used this kind of conceit of breaking things down into denominations. I used the kind of palette of grey as a neutral. Sometimes I use Hessian or canvas as this kind of neutral language. But within it, I use these the way that some images are broken down into RGB. Sometimes it's CMYK. But on this occasion, I employed red, green, and blue as these common denominator colours that kind of punctuated the show, and that is the wheel that I was talking about earlier that kind of made me make those ceramic wheels, which I used a manganese glaze developed by Hans Koper in a recipe of my own, which makes it very volcanic or they call it volcanic, which means it just bursts and pops. So it has the feeling of provenance and posterity. So it looks like it's been in the sea for 1,000 years, but actually it hasn't. And often I'll use what I call the sort of furniture of display, which is the various trends within institutional architecture to display objects like formica and Hessian and acrylic and steel, in order to house kind of pre-existing objects. The object with its back to us at the moment was cast from a medieval corbel, or late medieval, early Renaissance corbel, which had dried mushrooms from a local Chinese shop near my food store, near my studio. So there's always something that relates it back to my locality, but also to sort of history and to my current parallel sort of research. The piece on the wall is made of mylar, and it's called perigee apogee, and it's based on how orbits operate, not just how orbits operate in astronomy, but how we operate around objects and get closer to them and more distant from them when it suits us. This is a sculpture called Who Conjured You from the Clay? And it's related to this film called Zardos, which was made by John Borman. And in it, this it's set in the future, but it could easily be any time. This pastoral idyll is this pastoral. Oh dear, oh dear. Okay, it's about time I wound up. So this pastoral idyll is maintained by these immortal people, these scientists who've discovered the theory of the way to become immortal, and then they maintain this chaos around their pastoral idyll, where they get these people to go and slaughter the population and worship guns and blood, and they send this head around, and they based it all on the Wizard of Oz, and they took Wizard and Oz and turned it into Zardos and created this god who spits guns out. And I tried to get John Borman to come and talk about it as part of the program, but he wasn't available, he was away, but it would have been great to hear him talk about it. And so I just thought about how we create these images, you know, in this you know, I think there's something interesting about, as humans, our will to become iconoclastic and to create icons that we can attribute things to. And so I've got half of Zardos down there, and then this curious bearded gentleman who has no necessary, doesn't really have a provenance. It's difficult to tell whether it's a kind of Renaissance figure or an Oriental figure, but it fulfills what we usually attribute to a historical sculpture of bearded gentlemen, and I think that's partially why I end up making these things. This is the way that I showed that film in relation to the ceramic that I developed from it. Oh God, I forgot about this. Okay, now we're back in Bristol. And what does it say there? That's what it is. Handel Cosham Hospital, Public Art Commission, Bristol. Now, I was kindly invited to put forward a proposal to make a piece of public art. I find it really difficult dealing with the notion of public art in general, certainly in relationship to numerous portrait busts of barbaric soldiers and what have you that we're usually accustomed to seeing in high streets or what have you. So when I found out it was for an NHS trust, I was quite happy about that, but I still thought, well, they're not going to be interested in anything I'm going to do. And I went and did a visit with Michael, and I put together a proposal based on the idea of philanthropy, which is something else that I find deeply sort of disturbing, because, you know, we're in a climate now where people are being encouraged to be philanthropic, rich people, so that we can remove that philanthropy from the public sector. But for me, the overriding thing was that it had something to do with with the National Health Service, which is something that I just can't believe is being attacked, and I'm close to crying about that when I talk about it. So this is the building as it was when it was made by a slightly guilty individual called Handel Cosham, who'd owned coal mines in South Gloucestershire, bordering what's now sort of Greater Bristol. And he built this on some pre-existing mines, it turns out, in order to house, in some way, the people who died of various diseases related to mining, I think. You know, correct me if I'm wrong, anyone who's here. But to some degree, it was people with emphysema, what have you, who wanted to give back the money he'd taken. And this was a big thing in Victorian and early Edwardian society, that you would have, and prior to that, that there was this kind of philanthropy, I suppose, starting with people like Handel, who Handel Cosham is named after, Handel supporting things like the Foundling Museum, and Hogarth and Handel. Anyway, so I was really fascinated by this. And before the battery runs out, I'll just go along. So the place was going to be demolished. There was some kind of toing and froing about whether that should happen. My interest in utility and the National Health Service told me that maybe we shouldn't be sentimental about that. Maybe they should just knock it down and build a new state-of-the-art health centre. Sorry. You will never see it again. But I'll tell you, anyway, that I developed a piece of work around a plaque that was made, or at least made, to this guy Handel Cosham. And what I wanted to think about in relation to the plaque was the charter that the National Health Service had for the patient's charter. And to think about this plaque as a document, what I did ultimately was to turn it on its side. I was hoping that was the end. Was to turn it on its side and multiply it. So there's this kind of dialogue going on between philanthropy from the 19th century and then, you know, what happened ultimately after the Second World War, when people in this country demanded a better standard of living and a health service. Shall I try and turn it on? So what I did was to do some more of this sort of parallel research. I was interested in mining, I was interested in technology that surrounds the National Health Service and that is funded by taxpayers' money. And so I visited a hospital in Bristol with Michael, and we visited the radiography department. I was always interested in how they develop these materials. This isn't working. That can reflect the radioactive rays of an X-ray. And so within the piece, there's this aluminium, which I think is as a very democratic material. There's these aggregates that I've made from mining coal myself in the basement of a Edwardian neo-Gothic priory. I was going to go down a hole, but I think everyone thought we might not come out, so we found a place where this coal seam comes to the surface, and it was much more genteel, if not quite as exciting. And then I've developed these sort of plugs which will sort of punctuate and actually puncture this plaque, and the notion of like a slight pompous notion of philanthropy, and talk about our culpability within a system, within a social structure like the National Health Service, and within democratic sort of structures in general, and our obligation to be as free individuals, to be unselfish, if you like. And so philanthropy is an unselfish act, but it was only able for the few to be able to be part of that philanthropy. Have I got myself lost? I don't think I have. I think I've said everything I really wanted to say about it. Without the visual stimulation, sometimes I go off into some kind of direction. Huh? I've just been trying to turn it on. Oh, really? Well, I'd rather just end it there. And then if anyone's interested, maybe we could send some images of what's currently being manufactured. And I had a look at today. It's really working very well. But it employs things like the girders I talked about. It employs things like aluminium that I talked about. It employs coal. It employs aggregates. Basically, my whole practice is about aggregation. Everything that we do socially as individuals within the cultural anthropocentric sphere is aggregated. Just this lecture here, and it also talks about a kind of not necessarily a didactic approach, but a communicative dialogue, and giving back. And as an artist, I'm not necessarily interested in onanism, but I am interested in culpability, not necessarily culpability, but responsibility. So in the doorway of the new revamped building, I'm making this piece called Charter, which is based on the patient's charter and also is derived from this in the spirit of philanthropy, albeit a singular sort of philanthropy. This is at the current stage, this is the aluminium piece that was made in not in a fine art foundry, but in a industrial foundry, which I'm much happier with, and this is something that we strove to do. It turned out to be quite a difficult endeavor. The other part of it is being made out of a very technological fabric that's partially being developed in Bristol at the university. These intelligent carbon fibers, which I've tried to make resemble the original bronze of the Handel Koshin Memorial Plaque. And ostensibly or superficially, it seems like bronze, but in actual fact, when you get up close, you can see the carbon fiber within it, and it's an incredible material. End of slide. That's it.
Thank you, Stephen. It's really interesting to hear about your practice within a gallery setting, but also as a curator and then artists working in the public realm. We have about 5 minutes for questions. We have a roving microphone. So if you do have a question, can you wait for the microphone to get to you, please? Are there any questions for Stephen? Oh, Rose is one.
I was wondering about the video that you showed, and I was wondering about why you had kind of blocked us seeing the people with that big square that kind of roved over the top of people. Was it about process and about just about the materials rather than the human interaction with
them? Yeah, the latter, really. I mean, it of course it's about... I'm a human. I'm part of the anthropocentric cultural sphere or realm, if you like. But I wanted to shift emphasis from that kind of manufacture to the actual stuff itself. So it starts... with this occluded individual collecting mud from a mountain, crushing it, turning it into stuff. So I'm thinking about material as being performative. So material as its own kind of autonomous, auto-reflexive thing. That actually has some part, somehow, has some kind of culpability in the end result because of its kind of indwelling properties. And that's me sort of going out there as a very sort of secular Enlightenment individual. I'm trying to entertain this almost like a hubristic idea in relation to my interest in, at least certainly my political ideas, that there might be some kind of potency within stuff that we're trying to ride over in usually in favour of some kind of narrative or socially motivated network of interconnected subjectivities. So yeah, so I wanted to occlude it. I mean, it's kind of tongue-in-cheek, obviously, that I wanted to put this brown square over the individual and think about the rest of the material in question and its process, its migration, its kind of transmogrification from mud to a ceramic through fire and brimstone. It's actually kind of allegorical, but in a kind of purposefully problematic sort of way.
Okay, thanks.
I don't want to choose them myself.
Oh, well, no, I don't either. Okay. That makes two of us.
Is it you?
I was wondering, to what extent do you think it's necessary that your audience has background information about your work before they experience the piece to fully engage with it?
I don't think it's necessary at all, because the way I encounter objects, I don't generally have any background information, but I usually encounter them in a similar way. So all of the kind of meaning that I've kind of fairly or unfairly sort of burdened my subject with is just one side of that question. The other side of it is its nature as material or thingly kind of substance, and its kind of its resonance at large within the social perspective. So all I'm doing is making a kind of, if you like, a kind of a crucible. Where these things can sort of self-catalyze. I suppose you could liken it to some of the experiments that happen in the Hadron Collider or something like that. So that they're not there necessarily to make, partially to make things happen, but also to witness what happens when they collide particles and to observe the way that matter in the thingly realm and narrative in the anthropocentric realm play some kind of tandem dialogue or dance or whatever you want to call it. So for me, my interest in any object really is my personal perspective, and I want to shed light in some ways because I find out a lot of really interesting things. So there's clues within it. I think my work operates on several levels, so I try to make it do that anyway. And so the narrative that might seem oblique to the uninitiated doesn't really matter, because you're going to, by its kind of curious deployment or positioning, that strangeness should communicate itself, not because of me, but because of the nature of a thing in isolation, or things in relationship to one another within an array or something like that.
It's a point of detail, really. I noticed that I'm interested in the way you display, you show the work, and some of the works are bracketed within a metal frame. Not all. Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. I'm just wondering what the frame meant and why you did it.
Well, yeah. So it operates on two levels. It's, on the one hand, it's a reference to the way that things are caged conceptually as culturally cultural heirlooms, if you like, and within the museum, but also the way that we bracket things in general. So I think it's quite important that there's no glass in there. That it's just a kind of, I think of those things as drawings. In actual fact, they're just sort of three-dimensional drawings, and I've made, you know, different permutations of those that I haven't shown tonight. But it's part of my interest. I suppose it was stimulated, but it's part of my interest in the furniture of display and the various trends within display that kind of as folly try to think about showing work in a neutral capacity or in some kind of tabula rasa, so that we can understand a thing outside of outside of any contradictory sort of objects or an environment. But really, what's happened to that thing is just as kind of ridiculous and obscure and obtuse as well. The fact that we've removed the utility from an object. That's why I sometimes use musical instruments. I don't think I showed any of them here. Actually, there's a whole show that I thought I'd put in there that I didn't put in, but I'd have been going on forever. And so I'm interested in the way that a musical instrument, once it becomes priceless, and sometimes they're used, but often within museums, they're shut off, and it's a great expression of a thing whose utility has been removed. And it's about that, really. But I would also argue that thing's utility hasn't necessarily been lost. It takes on a new utility. And so there's always this play. And sometimes I'm more in favour of like the less anthropocentric perspective, and sometimes I'm more in favour of it's kind of social, the apparatus of the object. What Deleuze calls, when he's talking about social things like ideas, is the body without organs. But what I would talk about is the object without substance or something, the way that an object can transmit itself culturally. And that comes back to this idea of secular animism that I've got, that these things transmit themselves sometimes without being prompted to do so.
Thank you.
There's one over there as well, with the microphone. With Katharina. This person.
I'm not really sure how to structure this question, but I think it's very interesting that the first video you showed in your early work is so earthy and so sort of uncivilized, but your more recent work is about pixels and things like that. Is that a conscious kind of evolution? And when you're showing old, although man-made and modern like objects that refer back to older civilizations, is that a journey that you sort of want the audience to go on as well, kind of going?
Yeah. Well, actually, you've kind of, it obviously works because it's a very recent work. It's not an old work at all. I just wanted to show it first because it's emblematic of the way I kind of operate. But I think I purposefully chose some of the footage and used sort of analog synthesis and to play within that kind of collapsing or conflation of a historical migration or journey or conceit of retrospect, and the way that we make pairings or conflate or accrete things in a more kind of subjective way. In fact, that's and material.
Okay, so if there are no more questions, I'd just like to thank very much Stephen Claydon for talking to us tonight. Thank you. The image.